welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 259 of the podcast. And it is the 3rd of March, 2016, as I record this, a few days early, as I'm off to Edinburgh tomorrow, just as they predict snow and sleet and fun things like that. It is partially family and partially research, because I had an idea about a book set in Edinburgh a couple of years ago, and so we are heading down the catacombs this weekend. I do know how to have fun. So today I have an interview with Orna Ross about the new book, How Authors Sell Publishing Rights, which is a really important book for authors who want to take their author business to the next level. And personally, and we talk about in the interview, I think it marks a maturation of the indie space and the indie movement. As you know, just sort of 5 years ago, it was slam an ebook up on Kindle, and that was about the extent of what people were doing. And then print on demand, and then audio, and then selling globally. And now we're looking at selling film and TV rights as well as foreign rights. It is definitely exciting times. And of course, we've seen the success of The Martian. And it's been amusing to see that so many people are not aware that The Martian started out as a self-published book. And of course, then it went on to become an audio book. After Andy Weir self-published on Kindle, it then got picked up for audio, and then of course went on to become the movie. And then sold print rights. So this is the thing. There are so many opportunities, and there are more and more examples of indie authors who've had successful, sales of different rights. So this will be a really interesting chat. In publishing news this week, Amazon announced that ebooks are now part of the popular Amazon giveaway tool at amazon.com/giveaway. This is especially good news for authors who use KDP, because so far it's only been for print and been therefore quite expensive. So I will link to that in the show notes. But that is definitely something for people to consider, as it can grow your traffic and also has integration with Twitter, so it can grow your Twitter following as well. Also, an article on Written Word Media under What Are Successful Authors Doing, which is a really interesting post, and they talk about financially successful authors who earn over $5,000 a month from book sales, based on a sample of 19,000 authors. And probably the most interesting thing that they found, I think, is that these authors who earn over that amount have published on average 13.75 books. Now, as someone who does earn over that amount, I would agree. And I obviously, like everybody, I started out with one book in 2008, and I now have 18 books, not counting the colouring books, 18 books without including the little ones. So even more than that, but various genres. And I can tell you that I think that is pretty true based on my own experience, that one book, even five books, even 10 books are not going to make you $5,000 a month consistently. And I think that's the thing. If you want to make a living as an author, then it really is looking at a long-term view. But again, that was me in 2008. It was one book, and we're, 2016, coming into the book number 19. And it just takes a step-by-step approach, a little bit every day, a little bit of creation, a little bit of learning, a little bit of marketing, and those intellectual property assets will stack up over time, as we'll talk about in the show with Orna. Okay, so thanks to everyone who emailed or commented on the Adult Colouring Book Show with Meg, which gave lots of people some ideas. And thanks to those who have bought and commented on an English Country House and Garden adult colouring book a fine art colouring book, which I've done with my dad. And you can listen to last week's show if you want to hear more about that. Okay, so here's what you've sent me in the last few weeks. Noelie in Belgium says, I'm listening to your cheery voice while driving to work on a rainy Thursday in southern Belgium. Your colourful podcast with Meg uplifts my spirits. Fantastic. David says, it's funny, even when these podcasts aren't particularly relevant to what I'm aiming to do, there's always something useful in there which helps build up a picture of the whole industry and do's and don'ts and tools and images, all good stuff. I'm so glad you said that, David, and I think that's really important, is that even if there's a topic that people aren't particularly interested in, then, you know, if you do have time, then listening anyway, because I think we all get ideas from so many places. And all this stuff goes into our subconscious and it all comes out at other points. Joseph Ramsden says, loving the podcast, just discovered it last night. Enlightening, keep it up. And I wanted to mention that one because this is what is so great about having a podcast or having a blog, having books. All of this is relevant because people discover things all the time. It's like people get so obsessed with the launch week or the launch month of a book, but especially for indie authors, that is not the point. And it's not the point if you launch a podcast or a blog either. It's more likely that years later, people actually discover what you've been doing. And then, of course, if you have, say, 259 episodes of a podcast, they have a lot to go back and listen to. Or if you have 13.75 books, they have a lot to buy. So don't worry if things don't look successful when you first start out. It is the long-term game that makes it worthwhile. Christine Niles, listening to the podcast, getting exercise and confusing the dog. And there's a picture of a cute dog looking up at the treadmill, which is pretty funny. Monica Rodriguez, another commute with so many ideas. Thanks for the inspiration. Ahmed Shukri, I loved your talk with Tololope Popula. As a North African Egyptian, it gave me hope and inspiration to finish my novel. Thanks, Ahmed, and great to hear from someone from Egypt. I love Egypt. It's one of those countries that ever since I was a little girl, I used to, you know, talking of colouring books, I would go and get the ancient Egyptian colouring books and do hieroglyphics and stuff like that. And my book, Ark of Blood, is mostly set in Egypt. So yeah, fantastic to hear that. Jez De Silva says, just retweeted one of my tweets about the podcast and said, one of the best writing podcasts out there. Thanks, Jez. And I also wanted to mention Jez because he's in Australia and it looks like I might be coming down under at the end of the year for some time in Australia and New Zealand. And I will definitely be running seminar events. So if you're in Australia or New Zealand, make sure you're on my email list and you can sign up at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. And I will be sending out emails later on this year once that's all firmed up. But it's pretty firm, mainly because it's been so miserable this winter in England that we're determined not to do that this year. Kyle says, listening while waiting for the bus, your podcast make me smile. Picture of a sunny day. And finally, Daniel Parsons said, listening to Meg's interview on the podcast, the honesty was really insightful about adult colouring books. Super. And of course, we like to keep it real on the show. So please do email me or tweet me with what you're doing while listening to the show and any pictures of where you are. As ever, I really appreciate the interaction we have and hearing what everyone's up to. So this show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life. And Kobo, of course, is a big part of my own business as an author. I fully believe in going wide when you're doing this seriously as a long-term business. And I have, in fact, just yesterday published a new box set on Kobo, a 7-book box set, because Kobo and some of the other non-Amazon platforms allow you to publish bigger box sets and things over $9.99 price point and still give you the higher royalty rates. So that is very cool. And I will play a word from our sponsor in a minute. So this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. And the extra Patreon Q&A went out a couple of weeks ago, which is 30 minutes of me answering your questions. And of course, if you support the show on Patreon, you get all those extra recordings. And I really do appreciate the Patreon support, like the tweets and emails. It demonstrates that people enjoy the show and want it to continue. And you can support the show with even just $1 per show. And I only charge $2 a month, so less than a coffee a month. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Okay, here's a word from Kobo, and then we'll get into the interview.
Hi, Creative Pen listeners. This is Mark Lefebvre, Director of Self-Publishing and Author Relations for Kobo. What is Kobo? Kobo is a global ebook company born out of Canada. Kobo is available in 190 countries around the world. Now, authors like Joanna Penn already are taking full advantage of the fact that while there may be certain players, world's longest river, that exist and are quite prominent in a few nations, Kobo is available and continuing to expand and grow in territories around the world. And one of the wonderful things about being a Kobo Writing Life author is when you look at that dashboard and you see that you sold a book in some country that you probably haven't heard of before. Check us out at KoboWritingLife.com. And now back to your host, Joanna Penn.
And today I'm here with Orna Ross. Hi, Orna.
Hi, Joanna, and hello, everyone on Joanna's podcast. Delighted to be here.
Yes, it's great to have you back. Just a little introduction. Orna is a best-selling novelist, poet, and author of creative nonfiction. She's the founder of the Alliance of Independent Authors and has been voted one of the top 100 most influential people in publishing by The Bookseller. And today we're talking about her new book, How Authors Sell Publishing Rights, which is co-written with Helen Sedgwick, who has also been on the show and is absolutely fantastic. So Orna, we're not going to talk too much about you today because, you know, we've had you on the show talking about your stuff. We're going to talk about this book. So let's start with the definition. What are publishing rights anyway?
Publishing rights are essentially the permission you grant to other people to produce some kind of format of your work. So they are protected by copyright. If copyright law didn't exist, we wouldn't have publishing rights to sell. And a lot of work went into securing copyright as a right for authors. And as a result, we can turn our work into audiobooks, maybe have a movie made, reprint rights, even reprographic rights, you know, people who photocopy your work are supposed to pay you a fee, you know, so there are just loads and loads of different rights. And essentially the function of rights in publishing is to extend your readership. You know, why would you bother with publishing rights? To extend your readership and to add to your bottom line. They can really quite significantly add to the bottom line. And I think authors, indies, have not given enough thought to rights, which is one of the reasons why Helen and I wanted to write this book. You know, taking a publishing rights perspective on your work is, I think, the sort of missing link for the indie author. And it's really important. Trade publishing trades in rights because it's a valuable commodity. And very often in trade publishing, the assessment as to whether to take on a book or not, the rights department will be very key in that, and particularly for certain kinds of books, which lend themselves to rights more than others. But, you know, very often the rights department will be called and asked what would the rights plan be, and that will affect how much of an advance and investment a publisher is willing to put into a book. So I suppose we started off very much from the point of view, well, if it's valuable to trade publishing, it's valuable to indie publishers and to indie authors, but how we would might go about the business of selling them might be different. So, yeah, that's a long answer.
Yeah, so there's so many questions I want to delve down deeper into because, you know, people listening and going, oh, there's a lot there to talk about. But let's just, you know, take a step back, you know, forgetting indies for a minute. How have rights always been sold? You talk about a rights department. So just, you know, put it in the perspective of what still happens in, you know, traditional publishing in terms of how rights are sold. And I guess, what are some of the more common rights that are sold with books?
Yeah, it very much depends on the book. I suppose that's the first thing to say. So it is impossible to generalize across the board about rights. It really does vary very much. But the sorts of rights that a publisher will be looking at will be primarily, first of all, print rights in other territories. So traditionally, and this is changing, I mean, there are two kind of challenges in the writing of this book and in discussing publishing rights. One is that it is quite a complex area. And the second is that it is changing as we speak, and self-publishing is changing it quite considerably. So, but first of all, just looking at it from a trade publishing perspective, which is where the whole rights thing grew out of, and which to an extent as authors, we have to negotiate and understand, otherwise we can't do the job. So we may look at how it's done and decide I'm going to do it differently. But if we don't know how it's done conventionally, then we'll approach people in the wrong way. So how it has emerged traditionally is that the English language publishing world was essentially carved up between the US and the UK about 100 years ago. And they divvied it out, a bit colonial, divvied it out between them and said, okay, we'll go into certain territories. So UK traditionally has a very well-established Commonwealth publishing arena. So it goes into very easily Canada and Australia and various other Commonwealth or ex-Commonwealth countries. And then the US is South America and various other territories where it tends to be more commonly available. So you get a sort of a gentleman's agreement whereby I won't go into your territory if you don't come into mine. And so in Europe, you occasionally had a sort of a US version and a UK version coming into Germany, say, unless these things were kind of negotiated out. So the rights department's job will be to ensure that they secure the rights for particular territories and then go on to sell the rights. And contracts are designed really to take all the rights from you. Not that they think they're going to necessarily use them, but they want to be able to if an opportunity ever arises in the life of the contract. So they approach it from that perspective. They will start with a contract that tries to hoover up as many rights as possible, and the author or author's agent should, authors far too rarely do, but and good agents indeed can let a lot go too, depending on what's on offer and what suits them in terms of short-term gain, maybe that an author might prefer a more long-term approach. So, but we will begin with trying to hold as many rights as us, territories in place and so on. So that's how it kind of goes. Now along comes the internet, and all of that is just it no longer makes a lot of sense, because if you've got online sales, then you know you can't say, well, this is the UK version and this is going into blah blah blah. So very difficult. And then at that point in time, publishers started to purchase world rights. But in the old days, if you were purchasing world rights, you really paid for world rights. Now you're lucky if you get the advance that you would have just got for your home territory and Commonwealth, say. But you're expected to give away world rights for that. Mm. So yeah, that's kind of the history.
Yeah, and I mean that's you will remember when I was on a panel at the London Book Fair, and somebody, you know, an author in the audience kind of asked about selling world English rights and was kind of advised to take that, and I was like, what's going on? Because I don't think authors realize that world English means, as you say, all territories in the English language, right? And as indies, we can self-publish into world, you know, 170 countries or something through the channels we have, like Amazon, Kobo, iBooks, without signing these different things. So for authors who are listening who have already signed some of their books with traditional publishing, What should they be looking at in those contracts to see if they can exploit any other rights for themselves?
Well, if they've already sold world rights, it's very difficult to get those back, you know, unless the contract goes into reversion. You could possibly, depending on when it was signed, argue that, you know, when I signed World English, the internet didn't exist and I didn't have these options or whatever. But it's going to be a tricky one. So it's really, you know, it's before you sign the contract you need to start thinking about these things. And I have a lot of authors who come and say, yay, they want to do world rights. And they think this is a wonderful thing. They assume that if a publisher is buying world rights, they're actually going to be selling into all these territories. The truth is there are only 5 publishing companies that have the wherewithal to actually get you in through their own auspices and their own imprints. And they are the big 5. Outside of that, what they're doing is selling on to other publishers. Mm. They sell on to other publishers. You get, you know, the percentage allocated to you in the contract, which is 50% in a reasonable contract, which sounds okay, but you can get 70% yourself and control the pricing and control the marketing and just have a much more direct connection with readers by selling into those territories yourself and doing some marketing in those areas yourself. So, you know, now that self-publishing is there, you have to be comparing those two, and you have to be saying, okay, I am willing to go with you guys if you can show me that you have a plan here, you know, that you actually can sell more books than I can. Then it's worthwhile. It might well be worthwhile. The other thing is that if you sell the rights to a trade publisher, then very often, I'm talking now, if this is your primary contract for your English language book, you know, your home territory and, you know, that contract, if you do, all the rights sales will be aggregated against the advance. So you won't actually earn any rights income until your advance is earned out. Mm. So if it's a sizable advance, that you could be putting off that rights income for a long time. Whereas if you kept your other territorial rights, just sold them the English language rights or the US rights, then you can straight away start looking at other English language options, not to mention translation, and get that income more upfront. But again, if you've got a great publisher behind you and they've got a good plan, they can possibly reach places you can't. So you've got to make a decision. You know, it's a consideration. And in trade publishing, there will be a big meeting about a book and they will talk about the balancing those options. And, you know, they will look very carefully before they decide how much to pay out on a rights income basis. And you should do the same.
Yeah. And I think what's important to note here is that there are a lot of choices that an author needs to make. And I think, and this is a reflection on how indies have matured, like the space has matured. You know, people started out going, oh, you know, here's my print book, you know, from CreateSpace, and here's my ebook on Amazon. And that's kind of level one. But what you're talking about is going far beyond this. So I've talked a lot about ebook sales and global English ebook sales through these channels, self-publishing. But let's talk about print rights, because, and I'm just going to be selfish and use me. So, I would love to sell print rights in countries, because, as you know, I'm not massively into print. You know, I have print versions, but that's something I would like to sell. So if people listening or me would like to sell print rights in English or other languages, how likely is that, and how would someone go about that?
Well, in terms of likelihood, I think it is something that we are educating the industry to realize that they're going to have to do. So you are, when you're starting to sell your rights, you're dealing with two types of people. One is the most forward-thinking people within the industry who totally get self-publishing and are ahead of the posse and think from a rights perspective and, you know, are there. You don't have to convince them. That's a tiny, tiny, tiny proportion of rights buyers. In general, publishing is a very conservative industry. Some publishers don't even know self-publishing has happened yet. I kid you not. Rights buying side of it is more conservative. You know, it's a conservative side. So there's an education process going on. But what is happening is that people are beginning to realize that they can make money without buying up all rights. And the ideal for an author is to hold your lucrative ebook rights and then try to sell on print, which is what you're talking about. Traditionally, not that long ago, a print book was a hardback. Mm. There was no such thing as paperback. So the publisher, you know, when you said, I've got a publisher, you meant somebody was putting your book into hardback. The publisher then, they sold on the paperback rights to what were called paperback houses. They were separate. It's only in relatively recent term publishing history, you know, 30 years or so, that the same publishing house actually brought out first a hardback version and then a... So I see it as going back to that in a way. Mm. But ebooks are now the standard primary publication for an indie. And then they try to sell print rights. There's already a very established market for what's called reprint rights. And that will be when you reprint a different edition from the original print version. So a reprint might be a very fancy hardback, or it might be a cheaper version with, you know, less good paper and stuff in another territory, or it could be a book club version, or, you know, there are lots. There is a very well-established historical sort of precedent for reprint rights. Mm. So we're stepping into a zone of total possibility, except that there is resistance because the book rights are lucrative, everybody wants them, and publishers are trying to bundle it all together, and authors should be trying to pick it all apart. So how you go about it is really very simple. You write and you tell them, I've got this fantastic book. You're back to pitching. You're back to pitching the trade industry. And so you pitch and you tell them, I've got this great book. It's done such and such in ebook. The print rights are now available for sale. I'd like to sell you the South African English language rights. So you're really specific, or the, you know, North American, which would be Canada and US, or the USA print rights, to begin a conversation. So that's one way that you would.
It's so interesting. And I mean, I'm just, you know, writing right now, I'm writing Destroyer of Worlds, which is set in India, and I'm revisiting all my photos of India. And I remember being there, and most books are sold now in India, print, you know, print books. And like you talked about the cheaper versions, they're often a lot smaller. You know, what you see in Asia is these smaller versions, very densely packed kind of books. And, you know, I kind of would love to be on those tables in those bookstores. So, you know, part of me really wants this sort of Indian print deal, because it's very hard to do self-publishing right now in India with print on demand because of the cheap price that they have here. And I know CreateSpace will look into it at some point. But so you mentioned that it's easy. You just email and do this. But let's go into that a bit more. So taking that example, what would be the process of trying to find the most appropriate publisher for someone's book in a, let's say you have a specific country in mind, because you don't want to just scattergun the whole world, do you? You want to be quite specific.
Yeah, it really does make sense to look at your book first of all and think about where it fits. So the first thing you should do before you actually get to that point even is to do an assessment, first of all, of yourself, your own skills, and the book goes into this in some detail. What are the skills that are actually necessary to sell rights? Do I have them? You know, is this something I want to do? It's not something every author is going to want to do. And I don't think you said that I said it was easy. If I did say that, I'm taking it right back. I don't think I did. There's nothing easy about this. It's not for the faint-hearted. Selling rights is not easy, even for established authors and established publishers. It's very possible, however. And I will say that authors are willing to take deals that publishing houses and agents are not willing to take. Mm. So that's the niche where you'll kind of most likely slot into. So agents want a decent, good-sized deal with a big advance, because that's the only way they get paid. They're only getting 10, 15, maybe 20% at most of the deal. So the deal has to be sizable for it to be worth their while to put the time and effort into it. But if an author can get an extra £5,000 or £10,000 or £15,000 for a book, they're really happy with that amount. Mm. Now, no agent would get out of bed for anything like that. So that's where you're kind of likely to slot in. And if you can do that in a few territories, once you've done it in one, it does become easier to do it in others. And that's the English language. We haven't even spoken yet about translation and so on, which we'll look at in a minute. So do an inventory of yourself. The skills that you need are in the book. I'm not going to go into them now. We don't have time. And then do an inventory of your book. books in terms of rights, because some books sell better than others and some books sell better than others in certain territories. Again, the book gives advice around this to some degree, but you are going to have to do your own research because, again, everything is changing very quickly and going off. So let's say you want to sell your book into India. There are three or four approaches you can take. The first one is you can just get a list of publishing houses in India, look at what, you know, who publishes, the kind of books you publish, and do a scattergun 100, you know, a pitch letter, essentially telling them a little bit about your book, obviously sales points, and if you've sold well. And really and truly, there's not much point in getting into right selling until you're doing well in your, you know, at the primary level, however you define that, for a couple of reasons. First of all, because why are you doing that? You need to do well. You know, you need to know how to sell books, and you could be just getting off into rights and distracting yourself from the fact that you haven't actually managed to become a good publisher yet. And secondly, they're not going to be that interested. Yes. You know, they need to see some sort of sales record and some sort of proof that you have reader interest already. Otherwise, they don't know any difference between you and just the next person who fetches up. So do an inventory then of the books specifically in relation to that territory, in relation to the books you read. And how you do that is you look at, you know, industry magazines and online websites that tell you what's selling where. So a good source of information is IPR license, which is a rights-based licensing operation, which you can use in lots of different ways. You can use it just as a base to kind of hold all your rights together in one place, or you can actually actively use them to try and promote your books. And they have a magazine, and they, you know, you can read and catch up and see what's selling where. I would say the platform is not perfect, but I definitely think it's the best one. There are about 8 or 9 different platforms, and it is the best one and the most author-centric of the platforms. And they're in development, and we're constantly feeding back to them. So we're always interested to hear as well from authors as to how they found the platform and how it could be improved. So that's one way. So they have a long list of all the different rights buyers. And their magazine kind of tells you where you can go. You could look to get an agent who would do some of this on your behalf. It could be an agent at home who would take on your oeuvre and kind of put it out there. And we have a dedicated agent in the Alliance who is working with our professional members at the moment and hoping to roll that out more widely in time. But you can also approach agents in the territory. So they know the local publishers, and they are, and to be honest, if you sell your book, if you have an agent at home, that's what they're doing. They're actually approaching sub-agents in the territory and dividing the commission between them. So it makes sense for you to go and just have to pay one commission if you're willing to put in the time and effort to do that. And the other way then is book fairs. So if you know that people are coming, which they do, to wherever your local book fair is, BEA or London or wherever, and obviously Frankfurt is the big right sales book fair, is the biggest of them all by far, and most all the rights buyers in the world turn up at Frankfurt. So you plan a book fair strategy, and you line up people that you want to meet, and you go and talk to them. But most of this is now being done by email, and being done by people who don't know each other at all. So traditionally, though, it's a very people-based industry. People like to trust each other, eyeball each other, see each other face-to-face. You can, if you're really hopeful about your book and if you have a really good, strong instinct, also do a sales trip where you actually go and arrange to meet. And, you know, publishers and agents are much more open to approaches, particularly from people who have had some self-publishing success than authors often realize. So we can be a bit intimidated by that whole world, you know. But if you have some success, if you have reached readers and you can show that, and you're on a growth sort of trajectory, then honestly, people will want to talk to you.
And I think even this week we've seen, I think it was the New York Times with Meredith Wilde, you know, who had a massive hit with her Hacker trilogy, and now she started buying other books and marketing those. And, you know, it was funny reading the article because, of course, we've seen this happening with other romance authors in particular doing this and other people setting up as an imprint. This is not unusual, but that the tone of the article was almost this realization that authors could actually do this type of thing. And it was so funny to read it because I feel like they're just catching up. But you mentioned book fairs there. Now, I've been to Frankfurt with you and I ended up in the Chinese section just trying to shelter myself from the intensity. And many listeners, you know, won't know much about book fairs. Can we talk about book fairs in particular? Because when we were there, we saw somebody who just kind of said, you know, at one panel, what do I, you know, I've come all the way from South Africa and I'm not getting any books sold. So how far in advance should people plan either a sales trip or a book fair? And what are the best ways of them kind of arranging their time?
Yeah, at least 3 months. I would say start 6 months out, to be frank. So if you were seriously thinking of going to Frankfurt this year with a sales strategy in mind, I would say start thinking about it now and begin to think about who you're going to approach. And if you write to them, you know, earlier on, the early bird does get the worm here, because their appointments, it's really relentless if you're an agent. I did work as a literary agent briefly, and the book fairs were so punishing. It's every half hour, bang, 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 appointment, 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 appointment. And people are selling hard, you know, so they're going and you need to have all your paperwork in place. So you need a rights guide for each title that you're trying to sell with the sales point information, what rights have already been sold, if any, and so on. But mostly you need to have appointments. So that lady who had kind of just wandered in from South Africa thinking she could talk about her book and people are interested to have a little book chat, but they're definitely not going to buy rights under that situation. So very often the deals are actually done in advance of the meeting. The meeting is kind of to ink the deal. And so you really can't plan too far in advance, I would say. And you need to be strategic. You need to show you've done your homework. You need the buyer to realize that, you know, the book suits that buyer. They do actually publish fiction if you're trying to do a novel, you know,
that's
that kind
a very
of thing.
Good point. Yeah.
Yeah, all of that. So lots of research to do. So I would say, yeah, if you wanted to go to Frankfurt later on this year, start now.
And we're in February and Frankfurt is in October.
That's right, yeah. So start now by, you know, investigating the territory. What are the current trends there? Who are the publishers who actually publish books like yours? Who are the agents who deal with those publishers? What is kind of topping the charts at the moment? What is the self-publishing scene in that place? What, you know, what do they think of self-publishers and so on? And then get yourself a list together of approaches and then begin softly, softly with the approaches saying, I'm going to be in Frankfurt in October. I would really like to meet you. I'm such and such and blah, blah, blah. And the very fact that you are talking about going to a book fair and showing that you understand that's where the business is done, asking them if they are going to be there and planning in advance shows them already you've distinguished yourself from the person who just turns up hoping for the best, you know. Rights buyers are inundated with catalogues.
Yeah, you know? And there's loads of paper, isn't there? These things.
So much. And, you know, book after book after book after book, picture after picture after sales, just thing after sales thing. But that's why the personal touch is important. That's why, you know, approaches outside of the actual and well outside, that they get very busy as the fair actually approaches with all the people they already know who are convinced they have a great deal for them this year. So, you know, to try and work in the sort of gaps between the fairs makes a lot of sense, especially as you're starting out. Like anything in the author front, it's not an overnight thing. If you are going to do this, do give it 2 years for you to understand the landscape and to pitch well and to make your mistakes, to fail badly, to feel horrible, to, you know, go home and kick the cat and to get back up on it and go again. It does take time and investment of time, and you will feel at first. A book fair can be a very overwhelming experience. Mm. Then if you get on top of it, and I speak as somebody who, you know, I started in the literary agency thing, just I ran a writing school and we had some talented people coming through and they were getting such awful deals from publishers. That's where it all began and ended up then going to book fairs and so on. So we started from scratch in our agency. We had very little experience and we built a rights business and it did take 2 years, but we actually got to the point where it was. And I will say that people are open. If you've got a good, everybody wants a book that sells. If they think the book will sell, you'll sell it, you know, they'll take a pitch.
Yeah. So I know that everyone is now going, why would I bother? Because, you know, is it better that I spend my time writing another book in English? And that's kind of where I've got to with that at the moment. But I'm still really interested in this. But could you share some of the success stories that you've included in the book to kind of give people an idea of where they could be once their author business matures a little? And I put myself in that category. I'm not at the maturity level of doing this yet either. I want to be, but I'm getting there. So give us some of the success stories.
Yeah, I will give you success stories. But just before I do that, I want to stress it's largely an administrative job. So, you know, once you've done the research, which can be quite enjoyable and interesting, actually. Once you've done that part, the actual sending of the emails and stuff, I think, is best farmed out to somebody else to do on your behalf. So you're not getting caught in it and you can carry on writing and doing your other things. And it's something you just once a month or whatever would have a review of and push out there. So the research and the understanding the territory and understanding yourself and your books, that's the hard part. Once that part's done, it's not terribly time consuming. I do want to say that. In terms of the examples, these are some of the different ways that people have done it. And there is no one way to work with rights. I mean, the ideal is they approach you. And that does happen, you know.
It happens when you hit the top of the charts, but not everyone hits the top of the charts.
And it does happen further down. I would say it happens not necessarily top of the charts, but somebody who has a lot of books, you know, a good series that sells well consistently is also of interest to agents. So Dean Wesley Smith talks about himself and his wife Catherine in the book, and they just think agents are death. They won't go near them. They don't trust them at all. And particularly in the area of translations and foreign rights, they just feel it's ripe for embezzlement and authors don't know half of what's going on, and just go directly to the publisher yourself. And they've both had approaches from publishers and reached out to publishers, and both have done really well at what I would call that consistent level, that where the rights income is nicely supplementing what you have already. They don't put a huge amount of effort into it. And so it kind of, I would say they're probably leaving money on the table, but that's absolutely fine because they're getting on with their writing and that's where they've put it in their lives. We give the example of John Petherby, who wrote To Be or Not To Be, as in B-E-E,
Buzzy Bee,
which is a kind of a mind, body, spirit book. He used foreign agents, a selection of them. So he approached agents, and his thought on the agent thing was they have an in to the market that, you know, is just take too long for me to understand and to do. So that was his approach. And I think on last count, 45 or 46 different foreign rights sales. There's The Martian, which a lot of people, was a big Hollywood blockbuster movie during the summer. Now, very few people know that is actually a self-published rights success story, in that he published first of all on his blog free and put his episodes out as he wrote them. Then it was a 99-cent book on Amazon. Podium, he began to rise up the charts, and Podium, which is a very good audiobook publisher, approached him, and they made a very nice audiobook which won an award, which then attracted the attention of Hollywood, and now the book has obviously got a print deal after that, and so that was that. So that went up through the audiobook route. So, I mean, there are three examples. They just give you an idea of the kind of variety of the ways in which it can happen. At Frankfurt last year, I met a young woman at Mind, Body, Spirit again. She's a hypnotherapist, and she had just taken a stand in Frankfurt, done her prep, and sold the rights to 40 different countries, translation-wise. Yeah, now, on the spot, I'm trying to follow up with her since to find out how many of those deals actually did land and did come through, and I haven't actually got the answer on that, but she was super excited that day. Mm. And that's what I was going to say. At first, it's overwhelming. Then when you crack it, it's super exciting. It's really good fun, and you meet some very nice people. It's a side of trade publishing that's much different, much more interesting, because it's often, you know, people from different territories speaking even different languages, and you know, you just see a whole different side of publishing there, I think. And people, yeah, there's a real buzz if you sell a book fair. Is a really good buzz if you sell, you know, do a couple of deals. It feels nice.
And I think that's exactly the point. So there will be people listening who haven't even finished a book yet, and there'll be people who are currently self-publishing their first book. And we know, we've been through this, learning how to self-publish in the first place is overwhelming at first, and then learning how to market your ebook in English is overwhelming at first. But we master these techniques and we master the process, and then we move on. And we, you know, what becomes to me, I look at Dean and his wife Christine Catherine. But to me, I mean, they've been in publishing 40 plus years, you know, and are kind of, their processes have got to that point, as have yours. And I feel like this is, for me, I feel on the edge of this is where I want to go, but it's such a, there's a process that you have to learn. And like you say, as you get into each of these things, you master it and then you move on. So yeah. I can see that. And I hope people listening will realize that this is the maturity of the industry. This is people moving from just self-publishing an ebook or a print on demand book into this kind of future of the publishing industry, I guess.
You're making a really important point, and it is really important. I mean, I can hear already, we probably lost them already. They've switched off and said, I cannot possibly take on another task. You know, this isn't about doing this today necessarily at all. But what it is about, and this is the important part, is that knowing you can do this, so that at the very start, you are thinking in terms of, first of all, long term and wide, you know, that this book that you've put a lot of time and effort into, you can actually take it out in lots of different ways. You're not restricted to just one format on one platform. Mm. And the restricting yourself in that way is, you know, I mean, it's an option. You can do it. But I would suggest that a rights-based mindset is a much healthier mindset. You're not depending on any one sort of outlet. You're understanding that there are lots of different options. You're taking your time. You're not trying to run before you can walk, and you're not trying to do everything all at once. Absolutely not. But I'm just looking. The lights have gone. Sun's gone down. It's really dark here now. Some blue light went past. I don't know. So just take your time. Take your time with it and know that you can do it. And so then you won't. If you start to achieve any level of success, you will get somebody approaching you, and just know enough to know that you stop and you think. You don't go, oh, somebody wants to buy my book. Because if they do, and they're trying to take all those rights, if they're valuable to them, they're valuable to you. So to think about it that way from the start doesn't mean you have to do it immediately.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I'm, 7 years into this and I haven't really done this yet. So just before we move on, I mean, we've kind of talked a bit about translation because that fits into the global side. And I would say that as someone who's tried self-publishing in translation, for me, it is not financially viable to continue bothering. So I want to sell translation rights. The thing that excites everyone is film and TV. So just as kind of the last topic, talk a bit about film and TV rights, and because that's kind of completely different again, isn't it? You don't do that at Frankfurt Book Fair.
No, though there will be people, scouts who'll be looking and so on. But yeah, I mean, that's best done as a direct pitch again, I think. And, you know, there's a whole sort of, I mean, there are books and books written about how to go about this. But essentially, your best bet is people say, should I do a treatment or should I send the book or should I send the script? The ideal is all three. Mm. Actually have the idea, book, and the script based on the book. Failing that, have the idea and the book, but a good pitch pack behind that, which identifies the market, identifies the genre, you know, at least has a couple of scenes written up to show that it is visually interesting and so on. The book goes into this in some detail. It's a good starting point. I mean, the rights book we're talking about, it's a good starting point. But if you're serious about film, it's a very complex area. Mm. Translation rights contracts are quite simple, actually, compared to home territory publishing rights. TV and film contracts, on the other hand, by 100. So you need to think about how, you know, what you're going to do at contract stage, shall we say. Again, there are a couple of people in the space who are doing interesting things. There is Voyage Media, who have brought some self-published people through to actually greenlit projects now that are actually in the process of being made. It has taken time. We've been following them for the last 3 years, saying, anything greenlit yet? No, just options. But finally, they have a couple that have been, and that is the sort of length of time. It can take 4 to 5 years between option and delivery. So again, don't get excited about it. But it's well worth keeping your hand in there a bit and seeing what's going on. You've got the new, Amazon's getting into the space, and there are lots of people getting into the space. So it's again, changing as we speak. These new platforms are much more open to dealing directly with authors. And in this area, I think you're probably best, you and a lawyer, to look at the contracts rather than an agent necessarily, who isn't likely to have the contacts built up any better than you are, because the areas are so new. Hollywood's different, you know, having an agent and somebody who knows the right people, that does help. So, but again, it's pitching, it's having a great pitch, it's understanding where your book fits in the ecosystem, it's understanding, is it actually a film? Because lots of books are not. And then it's luck, huge amount of luck in these things, you know, and right place at the right time and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and Lee Child, I think it took 10 years to go from option to, you know, fall through and finally got made. Jack Reacher got made. I'd also direct people to the interview with David Morrell, who wrote First Blood, which became Rambo. And he talks about the merchandising off the back of a film contract, and that the money was very much in merchandising and sequels and writing the novels for the sequels, which is something like people don't really think about. But like you said, the contracts are so complicated that you have to be really careful. But it all in the end comes down to having a book, doesn't it? Having a book out there and more books, because one, you can't wait for a lightning strike.
Exactly that. And you build your books and you build your readership and you pitch and you put stuff out and you see what gives. You don't stop writing, you don't stop producing books for this. This is something you add on, once a week you dip into it, or whatever you decide, it's something you add on. It's not something you do instead of. And rights income is never going to, you know, rights income is supplementary. It's never going to replace the primary income from your books. And that's important. But it really can extend your readership, and, you know, going into another format makes a huge difference, particularly film, but also, you know, there are radio dramatization rights, there are merchandising rights directly from the book, depending on the kind of book you have. So some mind, body, spirit books lend themselves to merchandising, lots of children's books, obviously, other illustrated books particularly. But, the list of subsidiary rights is growing all the time. And this is an area that is growing, you know, and is full of potential, I believe. I really do think so. So if you're up for it and if you're ready for it, give it a go. If you're not ready for it yet, keep it in mind when you're talking to anybody about your book. And, you know, if you are thinking about starting here, I do think this is the only guide that I'm aware of. This is the reason we wrote it, is it's the only guide I'm aware of to this territory. It's very much an introduction, very much about, you know, locating yourself, and very much about creating that rights mindset so that you can begin to add this dimension to your business.
Super exciting. So tell people where they can find the book online and also yourself.
Yeah, well, I'm Orna Ross at ornaross.com. The book is for sale. The best place is the sales page on selfpublishingadvice.org. Just go to guidebooks on the rights book. It's widely available, Amazon, Kobo, all the usual suspects. And we'll have a print version probably for launching at Frankfurt Book Fair. So it's in ebook version only for the moment. And it launches next weekend at San Francisco Writers Conference. And all the writers there will get a free copy to take away. And hopefully spread the word down there where, you know, they're near close to film world and they can all start taking a rights approach to their books. I hope it will be useful to people. We'll be reading it's free, as always, as all our guidebooks are to our members. We're really interested in feedback. I know there'll be a second edition of this pretty soon because it is such a changing area. And also, we thought, let's just get it out and hear more from authors about what they're doing. And I'm sure there are super exciting things happening out there that we're not yet aware of, and we want to hear from authors about what they're doing. And I know you do too.
Yeah, definitely. So thanks so much for your time, Orna. That was great.
Thank you, Jo. Bye.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.